Well, the headline reads, anti-abortion forces turn to personhood. Personhood there is in quotations. It's a headline from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch from the Los Angeles Times. We're going to be talking about what is being noticed by the news as a quote-unquote new political strategy in the pro-life movement, the personhood movement. Scott Klusendorf joins us, president of Life Training Institute. You can join us as well here in the third hour. This conversation will last about another half hour, and then the last 15 minutes, we'll be talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt about this terrible punishment given to a rape victim in Saudi Arabia, find out whether or not it is typical of Islamic countries. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issue ZTC at KFUO.org, coming to you live this Monday, November the 26th. Scott Klusendorf, welcome back.
Todd, good to be with you.
Why is it important that we argue that the fetus from conception is not only human, but a human person?
Well, I take a little bit different approach to that, Todd. I think we should not argue personhood because I think we give away too much ground to the other side. The other side wants to draw this distinction between human being on one hand and human person on the other. The difference being that human beings can be killed, human persons can't. And the pro-lifer, to make a cogent argument, shouldn't concede that point. We should argue instead that all humans, regardless of size, level of development, location, or the dependency needs, should be protected in law simply because of the kind of thing they are. And when you inject personhood language into the argument, you're essentially saying there's one class of human beings that can be protected and another class that we can kill if it suits our needs.
Okay, so rather than arguing that the fetus is a human person, you would argue that all human beings or all humans are persons.
They are persons by nature.
By nature.
Yeah, and I would not draw the distinction. I would just say human beings should be protected from conception if I was going to write such a bill.
Okay. The story that is coming, this really is a national story now of
right.
The emergence of a personhood argument. What is it, whenever there's something new or allegedly new, it's always in answer to or in reaction to what has been in the past. What have been the past failures, or so to speak, of the pro-life movement and the arguments they've made in the public square?
Well, the argument that's going forward by advocates of this new personhood amendment strategy is that the pro-life movement has utterly failed. For the last 35 years, our incremental approach has gone nowhere. It has only served to result in more unborn deaths. We are no closer, the argument goes, to outlawing abortion than we were before, and therefore we need to get rid of this incremental approach for two reasons. Number one, it doesn't work. And number two, it's immoral because we are complicit in the deaths of unborn children when we advance incremental legislation that does not ban abortion outright.
All right,
that's the argument.
All right, let's deal with both of those. Is it true that the so-called incremental approach is failed?
Well, it depends how we define failure. If failure is defined as succeeded in ending elective abortion as we know it, then I guess it's been a failure. But let's be honest here. There have been many strategies at work, not just an incremental one. There was an attempt at one time to pass a human life amendment. That failed. There was an attempt to amend the Constitution. That failed. There was an attempt to get judges on the Supreme Court that would overturn Roe. That's failed. Why is it only the incrementalists are being held to blame here? Other strategies have included, well, let's just teach abstinence to everybody, and unless they're married, they shouldn't be having sex, and that will end abortion. Well, that hasn't worked either. What incremental legislation has done is reduce the number of abortions modestly in states where these bills have been enacted, and I'm not claiming that the reduction in the abortion rate has been tremendous, but it has certainly been notable. And then secondly, it has put important premises in the law that can help us in the future as we move toward total protection for unborn children. So I don't think it's been a failure at all. Rather, I think it's been pro-lifers acting within the situation they've been dealt to try to save as many lives as possible, given the circumstances the federal courts have forced us to labor under.
Let's deal with the particular, and that is, it was probably about a year ago that South Dakota made an attempt
right.
to ban all abortions within its borders and to become essentially a non-Roe state. Of course, that never saw the light of day, really.
Right.
And what was your take when that was happening in South Dakota?
Well, I think the bill was ill-timed. It's a great bill in principle. I don't know a pro-lifer anywhere that wouldn't support the kind of legislation that was proposed. The problem was the people proposing it had not done their arithmetic. We do not have the votes at the federal court level to pass that kind of bill. What people seem to forget is that it's not pro-lifers who are saying, oh, we'll legislate in such a way that some unborn children can be killed and others won't be. No, the courts have determined for us that all unborn children have no right to life and can be killed for any reason the mother sees fit. And that is the real rule of law in our land today. And the legislatures of this nation, the individual lawmakers, their hands are somewhat tied because they've got to function under that federal law from the judicial system that basically prohibits them from passing a complete ban on abortion. So until we have the votes at the federal court level, specifically at the Supreme Court level, to overturn Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton and the Casey decision and a bunch of these others that prohibit us from acting legislatively, it's really unfair to say pro-life lawmakers have compromised because they haven't passed a complete ban on abortion. Show me the votes at the court to support that ban. And that's what happened in South Dakota.
Okay, so essentially what you are saying is the attempt in South Dakota to ban all abortions in South Dakota should have been viewed, rather than an attempt just on South Dakota's part to do its little part, should have been viewed as an outright challenge against Roe and therefore should have taken into account the complexion of the Supreme Court, which would inevitably have to decide the case.
Yeah, I mean, we've got two choices here. We can pass perfect legislation that has no hope of surviving a federal court challenge, and doing so might certainly make us feel better, but it's not going to save lives because the federal courts are going to strike it down. Moreover, Todd, I should point out that these ill-timed bills, once they're struck down by the courts, really serve to create yet another layer of established legal precedent against us, and at the same time, they fatten the pockets of pro-abortion attorneys because, remember, when you lose a court case, you pay the court costs of the other guy. And that means we're funding Planned Parenthood every time we take these ill-conceived, ill-timed bills to the courts and expect we're going to get anywhere with them.
The other point you made, the argument that's made by those who oppose the incremental approach, is that they view it as fundamentally immoral and complicitous with 1.3 abortions every year.
What's correct.
What, again, is their argument, and how do you respond to it?
Well, they're saying we're compromising. That their argument goes like this. Any bill that says we're going to restrict abortion but ends with you can kill the baby is an immoral law. Well, first of all, pro-lifers who support incremental legislation are not conceding the legitimacy of any abortion whatsoever. Rather, we're doing what Harry Jaffa calls wise statesmanship. And what Jaffa says is that the wise lawmaker, the wise statesman, will do what he can to limit the evil insofar as possible given the environment he's forced to work in. And that is a moral principle that is sound. Pope Benedict has reiterated that numerous times, even when he was Cardinal Ratzinger and was seated among the world's elite philosophers. This issue came up directly, and he addressed it directly and made it clear that pro-lifers who support incremental legislation are not compromising when they simply don't have the votes to pass the perfect pro-life bill. Rather, their moral obligation at that point becomes to limit the evil insofar as possible, given the constraints that are placed upon the lawmakers. And that's what incremental pro-lifers are doing. We're not compromising. We're working to limit the evil insofar as possible, given the hand we've been dealt.
I want to be careful how I word this question, because I don't want to be misunderstood by you or by anybody. Are we doing ourselves a disservice in the pro-life community by focusing on the total number of abortions in the United States every year And I guess my thinking here is, if we simply did that in an extreme case, we would not have been able to pass a ban on partial birth abortion. We would have worried about getting rid of all of them rather than some of the most egregious of them, although all of them are egregious.
Right. Oh, that's an excellent point, Todd. In fact, the very people who are squaring off against incremental pro-lifers and saying that we're a bunch of compromisers have decried the Supreme Court decision that limited the attempt to throw out any restrictions on abortion, namely the most recent pro-life victory, as I would call it, over partial birth abortion at the Supreme Court level. And in that decision, it's true that we did not limit the number of abortions. That ruling that we experienced back in April that basically said the federal abortion ban, the federal partial birth abortion ban would be upheld, and the Supreme Court did uphold it. That limitation of the pro-abortionists to stop pro-life legislation was a victory for our side, though I agree it didn't reduce drastically the number of abortions. And let me give you one example of how that decision helped us. In the past, Todd, what would happen is whenever there was a case that was brought before the federal courts, specifically the Supreme Court and the appellate courts, that involved abortion restriction legislation or abortion control legislation, all you had to do is tell the court that there was some conceivable situation out there where this law would be seen as unconstitutional and the judges would throw it out facially, meaning they would invalidate the entire law. What happened in this most recent partial birth decision is the Supreme Court, specifically Justice Kennedy, said no, that we are not going to allow people to throw out a pro-life bill that's been duly elected by lawmakers at the state level simply because somebody can imagine some conceivable case somewhere where this might prove unconstitutional. Instead, Kennedy said, you're going to have to come with a specific case with specific reasons why this bill is unconstitutional before we're going to throw out that part of the bill. Now, some might think, well, big deal. What's the point of that? That's huge. Todd, that changes the ground rules for how we do things. And for people to just write that off as no big deal, it's astounding to me.
Let's see what Steve has to say. He's calling from his car. Hi, Steve.
Hi. A couple of thoughts on the personhood that you were talking about earlier. First of all, if I recall my American history, the people who wanted slavery didn't want slaves to be counted as persons, but however they wanted them to be counted for census purposes for distribution of representatives. And so I wonder how that would compare to what we see now. The other question I have about personhood is we have this issue where the courts allow abortion, but then they also allow that if a mother is killed while pregnant, that a double murder could be charged to the individual. And it seems like we have a history of not understanding what a person is.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve. Your thoughts there, Scott?
Well, Steve brings up an excellent point involving cognitive dissonance, and that is that on one hand, our courts say the fetus has no rights whatsoever not to be killed if it suits the preferences of the mother. And yet, on the other hand, if the fetus is wanted and it's killed, we're going to execute a judgment against the assailant. The Scott Peterson case is a classic example. He's being tried for two murders in California, arguably the most pro-abortion state in the country. And yet, if Lacey Peterson, the mother of that unborn child, had wanted to kill that unborn child, there'd be no problem whatsoever. So, in other words, Scott Peterson can't kill the child, but Lacey Peterson can. And you're right, it's profoundly illogical, and these are the types of examples we need to bring up to the American people over and over again to show how ridiculous our court system is.
As to the historical question, are we still trying to sort out what was raised under the issue of slavery about who's a
yes,
human being?
Yes, we are. And the question we're still fighting over as a nation is this: what makes human beings valuable? Are we valuable for what we are intrinsically? In other words, do we have value and a right to life simply because we're human, which is what the Declaration of Independence asserts, or are we only valuable for what we can do functionally? In other words, because of our skin color or our intellect or our self-awareness or our ability to live independent of anyone or anything. That debate over whether we're human and valuable because of what we are or because of what we can do was at the heart of slavery, and it's at the heart of the abortion issue, and it's at the heart of the embryonic stem cell research issue. So, yes, we have still continued to struggle over that question.
I wonder, regarding two things, both the makeup of the Supreme Court and the overturn of Roe v. Wade, everyone, if they're honest, must admit to being an incrementalist. You do not replace the entire Supreme Court. I've seen no one suggest that we write up articles of impeachment for the pro-choice Supreme Court justices and replace them.
Right.
That would be the unincremental approach. No, everyone says let's replace them one at a time. With regard to the overturn of Roe v. Wade, you overturn Roe v. Wade, but the question then returns to the states. That is, in essence, also an incremental approach, isn't it?
Right. Oh, yeah, it is. And if we want to add a little more history to this, let's not forget that many of the major social reform movements we saw in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries proceeded incrementally. Martin Luther King did not establish equal rights for all American blacks with one fell swoop. William Wilberforce did not end slavery in Great Britain. Instead, what he did is, after he failed to get total protection for slaves, he and his colleagues got together and said, well, let's work incrementally to outlaw this thing. And the first thing they did is prohibit, and got their colleagues in the House to go along with, or with, in the Parliament to go along with it. He got them to go along with the sponsorship of the slave trade. And then after that, he finally worked several years later in succeeding in banning it outright. Now, here's my question. Was Wilberforce a moral compromiser because his incremental legislation essentially said, we're going to ban certain aspects of slavery, but oh, by the way, you can still own a slave?
Then, to the issue of the Supreme Court, these things change so very, very slowly.
Yeah.
And without any certainty, we're facing a presidential election where it really is truly unknown what the complement of the Supreme Court is going to be four years from now. Aren't we forced by simply, as you've said many times, the circumstances in which we find ourselves to take the incremental approach?
Oh, I think so. I have no doubt about that, Todd. The politics of this are going to ebb and flow, of course. And we just never know what it's going to look like 5 years from now. If you had told me 3 years ago that we would be looking in 2008 at a Congress that was totally Democratic with a wide majority and a Democrat president, I would have said, what have you been smoking? But that looks very likely right now, barring unforeseen changes. Politics is very unstable. We simply don't know the future. So we have to take advantage of what we can do now and try to save as many lives as possible right now. And I see no reason to abandon that strategy just because we have not achieved total victory. These things take years to get done. And because we've not yet done it doesn't mean what we've done so far has been a failure.
Are there two old axioms at work here? Politics is the art of the possible, and don't allow the perfect to become the enemy of the good?
I think you have to look at that. And some people would respond by saying, well, that makes you a pragmatist. You're jettisoning morality for pragmatism. Well, no, I'm not, because we need to define what we mean by pragmatist. One version gets rid of morality. Here's what I mean by that. Let's suppose someone says, well, you know, boys will be boys, so we need to be pragmatic here and realize they could get their girlfriends pregnant, so let's make sure we've got legal abortion available as a fallback. We got to be pragmatic about this. Well, that throws out all moral issues regarding abortion. But here's another way to think of being pragmatic. I don't have the ability to achieve a total ban on abortion. I wish I did. I wish all unborn children could be protected. I'm going to keep working toward that goal, but at the moment, I cannot achieve it. But I can achieve a partial protection for unborn children. And the question then becomes, why should I do nothing just because I can't do everything? Should I refuse to protect any unborn children because I can't protect all of them?
Finally, then, I want your reaction to National Right to Life's endorsement of Fred Thompson. 30 seconds.
I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I was surprised, personally, speaking only for myself, I would have gone for Romney. But that was their decision. Maybe they have internal reasons for it. I don't think that discredits them in any way. It was a little bit surprising. I think it's debatable, but I don't think it's a damaging blow against them.
What I'm hearing from my listeners, and again with 30 seconds, Scott, is not so much a problem with this guy's record doesn't stack up or this guy's record doesn't stack up. There's enough pro-lifers to choose from. The frustration I'm hearing from listeners is the inability of anyone who's vying for the White House in 2008 on the pro-life side to clearly and forcefully articulate the pro-life position in a cogent way to the mass of America. Your thoughts there with 30 seconds.
I couldn't disagree with that. I do agree with that. It's sad, and I think all of them need to spend some time with Frank Beckwith. I wish they would hire him and read his book, Defending Life. They would probably learn how to give a cogent answer.
Scott Klusendorf is president of Life Training Institute. You'll find great pro-life resources at prolifetraining.com. It's the website for Life Training Institute, prolifetraining.com. It's another place they probably should visit so they can hone their rhetorical and argumentative skills in the pro-life arena. Scott, thank you very much for being our guest.
Todd, always good to be with you.
Folks, you can help us defend life from beginning to end by making a year-end tax-deductible gift to Issues, etc. Now, any size gift is deeply appreciated and helps. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, by check, write us at Issues, etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117, or by calling our automated resource line, 1-800-737-0172. And for a year-end gift of $50 or more, we'll send you one of my Christmas sermons on CD. Thanks for keeping the worldwide outreach of Issues, Etc. in mind as we approach the end of 2007. Remember, 1-800-737-0172, our website address, issuesetc.org, or write us, Issues, Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. When we come back, 10 more minutes in the conversation, Alvin Schmidt will be with us. We're going to talk with Dr. Schmidt about the punishment given to a young rape victim in Saudi Arabia. It was startling enough to make the news and to catch the attention of the media. It is almost inconceivable how it could be. Does it make sense, this punishment for a rape victim in Saudi Arabia under Islam? Of course, Saudi Arabia is an Islamic country. We'll answer that question with Dr. Alvin Schmidt of Illinois College on the other side of this break. I say it often that politics is the art of the possible, and that we Christians, or even if you're not a Christian, you're just a social conservative, we do not have the luxury of living in the world we want to live in. We are required to live in this world as it is, with the game rules that are set, with the boundaries that are set, and with all of the limitations and frustrations that are built into it, and to do our best to defend life from beginning to end within that system. Now, if we want to change the system, that's an option too. Of course, that's also an incremental approach. No matter what we do, it will be an incremental approach, but we cannot stop. We'll be right back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
A sermon is supposed to be about justification and sanctification. However, after you have heard one, is there sometimes something that doesn't just feel right, but you're not sure what it is? On the next broadcast of Law and Gospel, we will examine such a sermon and provide you with some tools to distinguish proper sermons from improper.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
Next time on the Bible study, Genesis chapter 20, Abraham and Sarah lie again. Only this time, their lies seem to have consequences for innocent people. Let's talk about Genesis chapter 20 next time on our 10:05 Bible study with Pastor John Lukomsky. Listen to the Bible study weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts,
serving God's people.
Evolution, it fueled racism.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the new book, Darwin's Plantation. Ken, what does evolution have to do with racism? I mean, after all, people had racist attitudes even before Charles Darwin.
You know, I found it so true that when people don't build their thinking on the Bible, they can end up with incorrect thinking. Oh yes, there were people with racist attitudes towards certain cultures before Darwin, but it's a fact of history that Darwinian evolution fueled racism. The late evolutionist Dr. Stephen Jay Gould stated in one of his books, quote, "Biological arguments for racism may have been common before 1850, but they increased by orders of magnitude following the acceptance of evolutionary theory," end of quote. You know, the point is, evolution is inherently a racist philosophy. It does teach that certain groups of people evolved at different times, so some people would be closer to the apes. And because of evolution, many people during Darwin's time treated certain native peoples as basically animals. In 1907, the respected magazine Scientific American printed an article that stated that the Congo pygmies were ape-like. And you know, sadly, many of these racist attitudes that were built on evolution persist even to this day. The Bible, though, beginning with Genesis, teaches that all humans are equal.
More about the origin of the races can be found on our website, AnswersRadio.com. There's also free information on dinosaurs, dating methods, and many other fascinating topics. That's AnswersRadio.com.
With worldwide KFUO, there are now more ways than ever for you to be a part of the radio ministry of AM 850 KFUO. Monty emails, "Dear Todd, I want to thank you for your Issues Etc. broadcast. I listen to the podcasts on a regular basis, and as a campus pastor in the LCMS, I frequently use your topics for my Wednesday night gathering. We'd love to hear from you. Please visit our website, kfuo.org.
How will you observe Advent this year? AM 850 KFUO and Thrivent Financial for Lutherans invite you to an inspiring Christmas performance that will enrich your family's Advent season. Experience comfort and joy with Chris Bergman and friends, and celebrate Christ's birth with word and a song. Wednesday, December 5th at Faith Lutheran Church, 6101 Telegraph Road, Oakville. Wednesday, December 12th at Christ Memorial Lutheran Church in South County, at 5252 South Lindbergh, and Wednesday, December 19th at Concordia Lutheran Church, Kirkwood, 505 South Kirkwood Road. All performances begin at 7 p.m. There's no charge for these concerts coming to three area churches thanks to generous underwriting from Thrivent Financial for Lutherans in St. Louis. For more information, visit kfuo.org. Comfort and joy with Chris Bergman and friends and AM 850 KFUO.
Wowie zowie. Today it was Dr. Kim Riddlebarger. Tomorrow on Issues Etc., his colleague at the White Horse Inn, Dr. Mike Horton, on Pop American Christianity. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. We've all heard about this punishment given to a young rape victim in Saudi Arabia. Terrible, terrible story. Almost inexplicable. We're going to try and get an explanation from Dr. Alvin Schmidt here in just a moment. But first here, let's listen to the story from ABC Good Morning America.
A story which has everyone asking, will the world rise up in outrage? It is the question of a prison sentence given to a young woman in Saudi Arabia who was brutally raped, but the 19-year-old woman was sentenced to 200 lashes and 6 months in prison because she was out of the home without a male relative by her side. It has a lot of people this morning wondering about America's friend, Saudi Arabia, and whether or not the anger will indeed change the sentence. Senior National Correspondent Claire Schmidt is in Washington this morning, where statements are being issued as we speak. Claire?
Good morning, Diane. Well, the government of Canada has called this barbaric, but the response of the U.S. government has been decidedly more muted, and it has a lot of people wondering why.
Even by the standards of Saudi justice, it's an astonishing sentence. 200 lashes and 6 months in jail to a young woman who was pulled from her car by a group of men along with her male companion, and then both were repeatedly raped. Everyone looks at me as if I'm wrong. I wanted to die. I tried to commit suicide twice, the woman said in her testimony. Her crime, according to the judge's interpretation of Islamic law, being in a car as a married woman with a man who's not a relative. And then when she appealed and took her case to the press, her sentence of 90 lashes was doubled. The case has provoked rare, if mild, criticism of its ally from the U.S. government.
I think that when you look at the crime and the fact that now the victim is punished, I think that causes a fair degree of surprise and astonishment.
Many of the presidential contenders have been tougher. Hillary Clinton called it an outrage, John Edwards appalling, and Barack Obama beyond unjust. This is a nation that says it wants reform, if slowly, according to two recent interviews with prominent Saudi citizens.
What is taking Saudi Arabia so long?
How long did it take women to achieve this position in the United States?
I know that you made headlines all across the world when you talked about driving for
yes,
Saudi women.
This is something that little by little will change.
And indeed, in October, King Abdullah announced what many had hoped would be progressive reforms to the justice system. But Human Rights Watch, which has been following the case, says this verdict means nothing has changed.
It can hardly get any worse, I think. And from the voices we hear from within Saudi Arabia, this woman has a lot of support.
Indeed, it is striking that several women's organizations in Saudi Arabia have been at great political risk speaking out about this, and in much tougher terms than the U.S. government. In part, that's because the United States is counting on Saudi Arabia right now in these upcoming Middle East peace talks in Annapolis, and they don't want to push their ally too hard, Diane.
All right, Claire. Well, thank you. Well, the world will be watching to see if the Saudis carry out that sentence.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt joins us to react to this punishment given this rape victim in Saudi Arabia. He's Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College, author of the book The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Oh, thank you for having me again.
Does the judgment of the Saudi courts surprise you in this rape case?
No, not at all, because it's part of Islamic theology. It's already even mentioned in the Quran in the 24th chapter or surah. In the second verse, it talks about giving fornicators 100 lashes. So she initially got 90, then it was more than doubled to 200, this lady that we're talking about, and then also added to that 6 months in prison. So it's, by the way, not only in the Quran, but it's also in the Hadith. The Hadith, which are the sayings and the traditions of Muhammad. In there are two particular references in that work where it, for example, says that illegal intercourse for a person is supposed to be stoned to death. And so in some ways she might even be lucky that she wasn't executed. And then there is another hadith statement that says that, illegal sexual intercourse, the prophet quoting him directly, take him away and stone him to death, end of quote. So no, I'm not surprised at all.
How is it in Islamic thought that the female victim of rape, as is the case with this young woman in Saudi Arabia, is considered a lawbreaker herself?
Well, she's considered a lawbreaker because a woman is not supposed to be in public unaccompanied by a male that isn't related to her. She may only go in public, like in a mall, where she was apprehended. She's supposed to have a male guardian who is a relative of hers, and if not, she's breaking the law.
And we've talked about this before, but isn't there some stricture in Islam that if a woman is raped, her testimony is not good enough to hold up in court against the rapist?
That's right. That, in addition to that, a woman's testimony in an Islamic court, as a rule, is only worth half of a man's. But this is quite right that you're saying that. It's true as well. So she really doesn't have any rights to speak of, as we think of rights in our society in Saudi Arabia, and not much better in a lot of other Islamic countries.
I guess what concerns me even more, if anything could concern me even more, is that this is a high-profile case because this woman somehow had access to the press and managed to get this message out of Saudi Arabia into the Western world and elsewhere where people are paying attention to it like we are. But this cannot be unique. There must be many women who suffer this kind of indignity and injustice every day under Islam.
That's very, very true. It's just unfortunate, as far as the Saudis are concerned, that this happened to break into the media. And she it broke into the media because she appealed the case and obtained a lawyer who, by the way, has lost his license for defending her. I don't know if that is widely known or not. I haven't seen it reported too much, but he lost his license as well. And so and another thing that's an interesting thing in this thing, the seven rapists were Sunnis, and the woman was a Shiite, or is a Shiite. And it happened in March of 2006, so about a year and a half ago, and the sentence was given in October of 2006, a year ago. It's just that it broke out now into the news media. Otherwise, we've never heard it. And your comment that there must be many other similar cases undoubtedly is true.
I guess my picture of Saudi Arabia was, yeah, it's an Islamic country, but they're so darn rich. They have a very high per capita. They must be more civilized than the other Islamic countries. And this couldn't happen where people have so much money and so much access to wealth.
No, well, in Saudi Arabia, women are not even permitted to drive a car. They cannot get a driver's license. And in addition to that, there even people who are Christians in Saudi Arabia may not have a Bible in their home. Saudi Arabia even has a hang-up and has been bothered with the arithmetic plus sign because it looks too much like a Christian cross. And, you know, back in the first Gulf War under George Bush the Senior, the Red Cross ambulances had to camouflage or hide the Red Cross on the Red Cross vehicles in Saudi Arabia. And we acquiesced to all that kind of stuff.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College and author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Thanks for giving us a few minutes to help explain and put this in context, this terrible story.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November is a children's book and a Christmas book. That means that if you're thinking about one of the gifts for your kid or your grandchild or your godchild, you might want to think about this Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for November, What Happened to Merry Christmas? You'll find it at our homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House and ask them about What Happened to Merry Christmas. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is called What Happened to Merry Christmas. It's a great children's book and a great gift for Christmas. 1-800-325-3040, or find the cover of the book at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Tomorrow on the program, Dr. Mike Horton is going to join us. He said some rather interesting things about Pop American Christianity in the past on this program. He's talked about them rather than reaching the lost, they're losing the reached. One of the things I want to ask him about is the now famous admission by Willow Creek that they've been doing just that, losing the reach. We'll talk about Pop American Christianity with Dr. Mike Horton of the White Horse Inn tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues, Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM 850 KFUO. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.